Yes, hello. Reading is from Ecclesiastes, the second half of the first chapter and all of chapter 2. So we're starting at verse 12. It's on page 670 in the Church Bible. Chapter 1, verse 12. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness, and what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and more flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all of my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can a king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their head, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind.
Wonderful. Good morning, everybody. Let me add my welcome to Tom's. My name is David. I'm one of the pastors of the church here. Great to have you with us, whether it's your first time or whether you're a regular. You join us just as we start a series in this book of Ecclesiastes. So do keep that open if you've got that in front of you. We'll be looking at these verses together. The book of Ecclesiastes is basically a long answer to a simple question. And it's tucked away there in verse 3. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. That's the question. What is good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives? It's a great question. It's our question, isn't it? And sometimes you might find you're reading the Bible and you're thinking, this part of the Bible is answering a question I've never really thought to ask before. Sometimes the Bible is teaching us good questions that we should be asking, even though we're not. Ecclesiastes, though, takes us to the question that most of us are asking. What do we do with life? What should we give our time and attention to? How do we decide what is good, what is best in life? It's the question Ecclesiastes is looking to answer. And there are lots of other answers out there, aren't there? You will find no shortage of advice that the things that people have to say or the things that people have to sell you are the secret to the good life. You should have these things in your life. These are the things that you should give yourself to. There are lots of ideas out there about how we should spend our lives or how we should have spent our lives. But this is the question at the heart of this passage and the question really at the heart of this strange book that we find in front of us. As we saw last week, the first thing that Ecclesiastes wants to drum into us as we try and answer that question is to know how short life is. And we saw that last week, and we begin again there this week. The first couple of verses are a kind of recap. Chapter 1, verses 12 to 14. And we're going to see here that there is nothing that lasts and the world is broken. And we had a kind of poem about that this week, thinking about the seasons, how they come, how they go, and how brief life is. And this week we begin with a kind of short report from somebody, speaking of their own experience. I, verse 12, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. This king is a bit of a mysterious figure. He's never named. It might be King Solomon later on in his life. He was king in Jerusalem. He was wise above many others. Maybe some later king. We're not sure. What we are really supposed to focus on is not so much who he is, but what he's got to say to us. And what he wants us to know, as we heard last week and we hear again today, is that everything is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Now, if you were here with us last week, you'll know meaningless isn't the best way to understand that. The idea is that everything is really like a breath or like a vapor, something that is there briefly and then is gone. It's a way of saying that our lives are short and they are hard to grasp. You could say that our lives are a mist and a mystery. That's the kind of idea that Ecclesiastes is trying to help us with, to understand how life is fleeting. Life is short. Life is hard to grasp. That is true, the teacher says, any time and any place. This phrase, under the sun, is a phrase we're going to hear over and over again. Speaks of where we are in this world. It also, I think, speaks of when we are. This whole life is lived from beginning to end under the sun. That's where we spend our days. All of life feels like this. And it's true of everything. Do you notice that, verse 13? What has he applied his mind to study? All that is done under the heavens. And verse 14, I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless. Everything has that same character. Everything is brief and fleeting. And if you try and grab hold of it, you're going to have as firm a grip on it as you would have of the morning mist. You can't keep it. You can't hold on to it. What is crooked, verse 15 says, cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. It's a beautiful way of describing something of the world that we encounter, that there is a crack in everything, that what is lacking cannot be counted. There are things that are missing, and it's hard for us even to judge what they are. You can't count them because they're not there. The book of Ecclesiastes has this way of saying that we live in a fallen world. It is broken and nothing lasts. And in some ways, this is a burden that God has laid on human beings. End of verse 13. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. It's the idea that we find later on in the New Testament, in Paul, in Romans 8, he speaks of how God has subjected the world to frustration in response to human sin. The world is now in bondage to decay and frustration. It has this character of mist and vapor. The days of our lives are few. They are short. They are hard to grasp. That's what Ecclesiastes wants us to know. Before we begin that search for what is good, how should we live our lives, wants us to know that our lives are brief. Our lives are short. And that our best way of finding what is good in this life is to take that to heart. Because as Ecclesiastes knows, we are very tempted to think there is something out there that would last, something else out there in life, in this world, that we could hang our hopes on. So as this king takes us by the hand and takes us on a tour of the world this morning, he's going to show us some of those places where we might look, some of those places where we might think, no, in this world, there is something that can give me some security, something to hold on to, something good. So first up is wisdom, verse 16. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. So here is somebody who has no shortage of wisdom. This isn't somebody who's not been able to go as far as they can in whatever direction they want to try and understand the world. There's no shortage of wisdom here. And yet, verse 17, I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. Why? For with much wisdom comes much sorrow, and the more knowledge, the more grief. Wisdom brings sorrow. How does that work? How is that true? Well, I think true in at least two ways. First of all, the more that you understand of the world, the more that you just see just how broken it is. Ecclesiastes is going to show us that. It's going to show us the oppression and injustice and cruelty that you find in the world. Something we're much more aware of now than we used to be, aren't we? I suppose that a few hundred years ago, I would have known about the struggles of a few hundred people for a few hundred miles. It would have been limited. I'd have known what was going on in the next village and the next town and in my family. Not much further than that. Now we have 24 news channels, 24-hour news channels and worldwide coverage. And so the scale of the problems gets bigger. With our greater knowledge of the world, we know better than ever just how broken it is, just how many problems they are. And they are global problems that we have no sense of, well, how would you fix that? Even how would you understand that? How did that happen? So part of the idea that knowledge brings sorrow is that we just get to experience the brokenness of the world. But there is also, I think, here the idea simply that the more you know, the more you know you don't know. It's actually a bottomless pit to try and go further and further into knowledge. I looked it up this week, and there are about 6,000 people in Oxford at the moment studying for a PhD. How do you study for a PhD? Well, you pick a topic. You pick a subject, an area, and then you try and narrow down and down and down, further and further, until you found one question that nobody yet has thought to write about, or at least not for some time. So there's one project that was done recently focusing on the religious life of people in Tudor England, in Norfolk, between the years of 1530 and 1558. Okay, they narrowed it right down to the religious life of people in Norfolk, in Tudor England, between those 28 years. And if you could find them and ask them, did you bottom that out? Did you find out everything that there is to know about life in Norfolk between 1530 and 1558? No, hardly scratched the surface. How could I? There was so much more that I could know. And do you know what that person would live in fear of? You asking, what about Suffolk? What about 1600? I don't know. The more that you know, the more you know you don't know. It is bottomless. It is endless. And so there is a kind of sorrow that comes with knowledge. You only really learn how much you don't know. So whatever people tell you, knowledge is not power. In lots of ways, knowledge is there to show you you don't know. You are limited and finite. Wisdom brings sorrow. What about good times and great works? Chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. The teacher says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. What does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the days of our lives. Here is a search, always guided by wisdom, but trying everything that people look to. And what we'll see later on is that he's not against the thought of enjoying food and drink together. But what he wants us to know is if you live for pleasure, then those things, like everything else, are just a mist. If you decide that that's what makes a good life, then they are only going to disappoint you. So you know that, don't you? If you go out saying, tonight, we are going to have a really good time, it always disappoints. If that's what it really depends on, if you're desperate for that. Or there's that kind of laughter at a party where somebody is just trying a bit too much to show how fun this is, or what a great sense of humor that they have. In that way, the laughter just becomes a little empty, a little mad. So he turns to great projects, verse 4. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. Male and female slaves had other slaves who were born in my house. I owned herds and flocks more than anyone in Jerusalem before me. Silver and gold for myself, the treasure of kings and provinces. Male and female singers, a harem, everything that he could have. And what does he learn? Well, there is some enjoyment to be had there, some delight in those things. He says, I denied myself nothing. I refused my heart no pleasure, and my heart took delight in all my labor. This was my reward for all my toil. And yet, what is the sum? What is the end? Verse 11. When I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Why does he reach that conclusion? Why was it all, in the end, meaningless? Well, I think there's a hint of a couple of things here. Firstly, the kind of isolation that gathering all of those things actually brings to you. Do you see how he ends up feeling set apart from everybody else? I had more than everybody else. I surpassed everybody else. And almost everyone that he looked around for worked for him, was his slave. And all those things he built for himself. And the King James Version actually does a great job of translating this verse because it keeps pointing back to him. It reads, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards. So there is something here about just gathering more and more for himself in a way that isolates him, in a way that elevates him over others. But then also the sense that he just can't hold on to it forever. These gardens that he's built, in some ways, I think, are supposed to be quite self-sustaining. It's a very modern kind of garden. There are water sources. There are reservoirs to water the groves. There are flourishing trees, so there's a supply of timber for the houses and the buildings and whatever else. But the king knows he won't be around to enjoy those things. He's planted something that will outlast him, and so he won't be able to enjoy it forever. So here is somebody who can say to you, I had everything, and it wasn't enough. In verse 12, we come back to wisdom again. At the end of chapter 1, he's wanting us to know that wisdom is a source of grief. Now he's ready to show us that it's a lot like those great projects that we've just been talking about. That there is wisdom, it's good to have, there's a blessing to be found there, but in the end, you can't keep it. And he's going to say the same thing about wisdom. Wisdom is a good thing to have. It's good to be wise. Have a look there at verse 13. I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their heads while the fool walks in the darkness. It is good to be wise. It's a temporary blessing. But then I said to myself, I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. Then what do I gain by being wise? This too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So wisdom, like the labors of his hands, good to enjoy for a time, but cannot last, will not last. Death will put an end to it. So he turns to his work, verse 17, and pushes that thought a little bit further still. If death is the thing that means the wise and the fool are really just the same, and if death is the thing that means that the rich and the poor are just the same, now he thinks a bit more about the future and what comes after. What about after you've died? What's going to happen? Well, verse 18, I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. So there is no gain to be had there. To think about the future is to know that things are then utterly out of my control, and all the things that I've worked for will come to nothing. So this teacher, the one who had more wisdom than we have, and more possessions that we have, and labored harder and longer and with more success than we will ever have, has this to say to us about life in this world, that there is no gain. There is nothing from any of those things that you are going to be able to hold on to. So don't spend your life chasing knowledge or pleasure or wealth or work. There is no lasting gain. Just remind ourselves of why that is. In part, it's because you will just never feel like you have enough. And that is the chasing after the wind. You're never going to hold something in your hands. You're never going to be at rest. It's the Camp Bells problem. Do you know Camp Bells? It's that hill just next to Lake Derwent in the Lake District. And it's often the first climb that families will have a go at, because it's not a very big hill. It takes about an hour to get from the bottom to the top. But it's a killer because you look up and you see the summit and you slog your way up there. And then it dawns on you, it's not the summit. There's another thing just behind it. And to get there, you've got to go down, and then you've got to climb all the way up again. And then you get near the top of that one, and you look up, and that's not the summit either. There's one more. And you've got to go up again, and it's a long, steep scrabble up some rocks. It's how these things will go for us, pursuing pleasure or wealth or wisdom. They are a chasing after the wind. You never quite arrive. And then living for these things, they will destroy the very thing they offer. The very thing, it's an odd thing, but they will eat out the very thing that they're encouraging you to trust in. So take wisdom, being seen to be as knowledgeable as you can be. If you build your life on that, you're actually always going to be sensitive to the things that you don't know. You're actually always going to be afraid of seeming stupid to people, of being caught out. Instead of being able to enjoy the things that you know, it's going to be a source of pride and a source of fear. Or your appearance. If you build your life on that, then you are always going to be seeing faults in the mirror. You won't actually be able to enjoy the beauty that you have, because you'll always see the things that could be better. You'll always see the person who is younger or more attractive coming up behind. And then, as Ecclesiastes keeps reminding us, death will come As Paul says in 1 Timothy, we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. None of these things offer us this lasting gain. And it's where that word is really helpful. It's the idea of profit. When all of the accounts are settled, when your life is done, are you in credit? Is there anything there at the end? And Ecclesiastes is trying to help us to see none of these things can actually put something in your hand that you get to keep after death. You come into the world with nothing, and you can take nothing out of it. It's why one of the best books about Ecclesiastes, it's just got a new cover, but the old cover used to have a brilliant picture on it. It was a picture of a sandcastle. And it's such a good image for what we're talking about. Because what is a sandcastle? A sandcastle is something that you spend a day enjoying and building there on the beach. But what do you know is going to happen? When you leave the beach, someone's going to come kick it down, or the tide is going to come in and wash it away. There will be nothing there at the end. None of these things can bear that kind of weight to give us a profit at the end of life, to leave us with something after all of that. It's what Jesus spoke of when he said, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. There is nothing in this world, in this life, that can give you those lasting treasures. And the king here, the teacher, is wanting you to learn from his experience. He's gone on this quest, he's gone on this search for us. He's saying, take it from me as somebody who had all of these things. Remarkably, there's a long list of celebrities ready to tell us the same kind of thing. Those who have experienced more success and more wealth than we might ever experience. And so Brad Pitt, he said, I know all these things are supposed to seem important to us, the car, the house, our version of success. But if that's the case, why is the feeling out there reflecting more impotence and isolation and desperation and loneliness? If those things are supposed to satisfy us, why do people feel so powerless, so isolated, so desperate? Lady Gaga said, I won an Oscar. I sang at the Super Bowl, but in some ways I still feel empty inside. Scottie Scheffler, he's the number one golfer in the world at the moment. Just after winning a tournament, he was asked why he does it. And he basically said, I really don't know. I literally worked my entire life to become good at golf, to have an opportunity to win that tournament. You win it, you celebrate. Get to hug my family, my sister's there. It's such an amazing moment. And then it's right. Okay, what are we going to eat for dinner? And life goes on. So he asks himself, why do I want to win this golf tournament so badly? Why do I want to win the Open Championship? I don't know. Because if I win, it's going to be awesome for 2 minutes. Then we're going to get into the next week, and we're back here again. It is a chasing after the wind. So what should we do with that? What should we do with that conclusion that there is no lasting gain? Well, Jesus will give us one direction to go in. He says, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy. There are treasures in heaven to focus on rather than treasures in this world. But where Ecclesiastes wants to take us this morning is somewhere else. It wants to take us back into this life and show us something so important about it. Comes in those last few verses, and it's the second conclusion that he draws. Verse 24, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat and find enjoyment? His conclusion number two is that there is no lasting gain to be found from any of those things, but they are gifts to enjoy. That we ought to eat and drink and find satisfaction in those things. That is what is good. Remember that question that drives Ecclesiastes? What is good for people to do in the days of their life, short as they are? And here is the answer. It is good to eat and drink and find satisfaction in our work. This is from the hand of God. This is his gift to us. Not looking to the world for gain, but seeing it as a gift. Realizing that in some ways God has just put this world into frustration and futility. That's the first mention of God in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 13. He's laid that heavy burden on mankind. This world is subject to frustration, but it is also still the world of Genesis 1 and 2. It is still the world that he made. And it is still a world where we get to enjoy these things as good gifts to us. Not as gods that are going to keep us safe, but as goods that we can enjoy. So the teacher, the king here, would want to say to you, your education, it isn't the stepping stone to earning more money, getting that graduate job, landing the big salary, making a lasting legacy for yourself. But it's a joy in itself to learn more of God's world, to know that you won't know everything, but to enjoy his creation and the knowledge of it. I'll say about our work that it doesn't define you. It doesn't tell you who you are or what you're worth. But there are parts of your work that you will be able to find joy in and satisfaction in. It is such a different way of seeing the world that Ecclesiastes is trying to encourage us into. Not thinking that there are things in this world that we can take hold of and control, but instead to realize that this world is full of gifts that we can enjoy. Someone said the mistake that we make is that we think that living in this world is like owning a dog. What is it to have a dog as a pet? Well, it's to have something that you can train. I know this doesn't always work, but just go with me. Something that you can train, something that's controllable. You can say to a dog, sit and stay and roll over, and it does what you want, and it behaves, and you're in control. Life is not like owning a dog. Life is like owning a cat. Life is like owning a cat. Again, you might not be a cat person. Go with me for a moment. What is it like to own a cat? Well, it is to know that you are not in control, but through your day, there are going to be these moments of spontaneity, unmerited. You've done nothing to deserve this. They're delightful. They're unpredictable. They're different each time, but they come and they last for as long as they're going to last, and then they go again. That's what this life is, Ecclesiastes says. How we ought to think of the good things that we enjoy, what we get to eat, what we get to drink, what we get to do with our lives. This, Ecclesiastes says, is the way to see the world. To know that this is what is good in the short days of our life, to take those moments and to know that they come from the hand of God and to give thanks to him for them. Just think as we finish. How that transforms a mealtime. Just think about meals for a moment. Some of them, we just try to invest with so much importance, don't we? The great kind of celebratory meal, the Christmas meal, where we think everything must be perfect and we feel that pressure and we're chasing after the wind. Doesn't work. You never get that perfect meal where everything is just right. We usually leave something in the microwave that we forgot to bring to the table, or somebody's ill, or somebody can't be there, or whatever. Some meals we invest with all of those hopes. But most of our meals, I would guess, aren't like that. Most of our meals are really just kind of fueling stations. We're just thinking, we've got to get on, we've got stuff to do, we need to just fuel up and get out and get on with life. Don't most mealtimes feel like that? Ecclesiastes 2 says there's a third way to do that. To sit around a table and to recognize that these things are gifts from God. To hold them lightly, to hold them loosely, but to give thanks to him as we enjoy them. That is good. That is the gift of our God. Let's pray. Our Father, we want to thank you for the bracing news of Ecclesiastes. Those remind us that our life is just a breath, and that our lives are so quickly gone, and that they are so hard to grasp, that there is so much that we don't know, so much that we don't control, so much that we cannot hold on to for any length of time. Well, Father, we pray that please, knowing that, you would help us to see that it is good to see the world as filled with gifts from your hand, to enjoy eating and drinking and to find satisfaction in our toil, knowing that parts of that will be hard and frustrating, but knowing that those things come from you, and giving thanks to you, we can find enjoyment. We can enjoy that measure of wisdom and knowledge and joy, seeing that you give these things to us. So help us, we pray, to live wisely in these ways, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.